नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 23, Maharaj Prithu's Going Back Home, text number 간디카시 드람토예 이타스타남 비하그샤 시팀 암바시 타티자시 에도바요 나바시옴 간디카시 드람토예 Dastanam vibhagasha Shithim ambasi tat tejasi Bhovayo nabhasyamam Kanyikashe drivamtoye Dastanam vibhagasha Shithim ambasi tat tejasi The different holes in the body for the sense organs. Akashe, in the sky. Dravam, the liquid substance. Toye, in the water. Tathastanam, according to the proper situation. Vibhagasaha, they are divided. Shittim, earth. Ambasi, in the water. Tat, that. Tejasi, in the fire. Adaha, the fire. Vayo, in the air. Navasi, in the sky. Mum, that. In this way, according to the different positions of the various parts of the body, Prithvi Maharaj merged the holes of his senses with the sky. His bodily liquids, such as blood and various secretions, with the totality of water. And he merged earth with water, then water with fire, fire with air, air with sky, and so on. Purport by Swami Gurudeva A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. In this verse, two words are very important. Itāstanam vibhāgaśaḥ. So they're the dual compound words. In Śrīmad Bhāgavatam, 2nd canto, 5th chapter, Lord Brahma clearly explained to Narada how the creation took place. And he explained one step after another the proper divisions of the senses, the control of the senses, the objects of the senses, and the material elements, and he also explained how they are created one after another, the air from the sky, the fire from the air, the water from the fire, the earth from the water, etc. It is important to know thoroughly the process of creation as it applies to this cosmic manifestation. Similarly, this body is also created according to the same process by the Supreme Lord. personality of Godhead after entering the universe creates the cosmic manifestations one after another. Similarly, the living entity after entering a womb of a mother also collects his gross and subtle bodies, taking ingredients from the totality of sky, air, fire, water, and earth. The words yathastanam bhagashaha indicate that one should know the process of creation and should meditate upon the creative process inversely and thus become free from material contamination. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is describing this chapter is called Maharaj Prithu's going back home. And of course we understand that going back home means going back to the spiritual world where the personality of Godhead lives with unlimited spirit souls in their spiritual forms, engaged in eternal spiritual activities. So, but this this process is very scientifically described here in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and it's described here that by understanding how the creation of the whole material universe is created after the Lord enters into the material universes, we can also understand how the material bodies, the individual bodies of all living entities are created in a similar way after the living entity enters into the material body. And if one knows that process, then to become free from the material body and from the material universes, a person who has that spiritual knowledge, the bhaktas, they can reverse that process and become free and go back to the spiritual world if they so desire. So, in the Bhagavad Gita, it describes this a little bit in summary. The 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, text number 8, it says, Sakidam yadvatnoti yascha yudvatishvara krihi vaitani samyiti vayo tantam ivasayat. The living entity in the material world carries his different conceptions of life from one body to another. As the air carries aromas, thus he takes one kind of body and again quits it to take another. So, in the previous verse 7, Krishna has explained that the living entities in this conditioned world, so they're taking these material bodies, he says, they are my eternal fragmental parts. So they're eternal individuals. Due to conditioned life, they're struggling very hard with the six senses, which include the mind. So because the living entity is eternal, that means that he is changing in this world from one body, and the same individual soul is then getting another body. And then from that body, he gets another body. In the Vedas, people understand that if they pray to the different demigods, they may be able to go to the heavenly planets where the demigods reside, or to where the forefathers did, the Pitchaloka. And then after utilizing all the pious results that allowed them to live in those heavenly places, they again come back down to earth. And then again they perform pious activities, and then they go back up to heaven, unless they make some mistakes and they go down to hell. But what happens is that after doing this, it dawns on them that there's, you know, something which is, if I'm able to go up there and get a demigod, if I have this body now and then go and get a demigod's body, then, you know, there's a constant individual that's changing bodies. So that dawns upon them after something, many, many lifetimes, gracefully to understand. And it just sort of clicks in. So, I'm already a person, but I'm changing bodies. So, because it's not possible for us to change our body unless we're permanent. And just like every time we wake up in the morning, we have a shower, put some new clothes on, that doesn't mean we become a different person. Every time we change our clothes, we become a different person because we're dressed in a certain way. Although, actually, because people have such a fickle understanding of themselves these days, that's exactly what they do. You know, they imitate the pop stars. Alright? They change everything, all their hair, all their clothes, you can barely recognise who it is. Is that Madonna? So they, you know, they feel that they're changing their identity, their personality. But anyone can see, now that's the same person. There's Michael Jackson, you know, who used to have different features. Now features look a bit more triangular, you know, a little bit more plastic. So therefore, that's the first understanding of how this change of body happens. It's not possible unless there's a permanent soul. So those living entities, we're all eternal, and thus we can. And it says that due to conditioned life, they're struggling very hard with the six senses, which include the mind. Of course, these days we have seven senses plus the mind. So we also have our iPhones. The seven senses. So we're struggling with our senses and our phones. And they're all grouped about the mind. So the subtle body, because we have a particular mindset, we get a particular body that suits that mindset, that way we're thinking. And that subtle body, the mind, when this body, the gross body, finishes, the soul in the subtle body, the subtle body carries one into one's next life. And then the gross senses from the gross elements form the gross covering of senses around the subtle body and the subtle senses. Therefore, in the verse 9 it says, the living entity thus takes another gross body, obtains a certain type of ear, eye, tongue, nose, and sense of touch, which are grouped about the mind. He thus enjoys a particular sense, a set of sense objects. So whenever I think of this verse, as a child we used to have what was called Mr. Potato Head. So it was a TV. I don't know if anyone's ever seen that. Have you seen that, Mr. Potato Head? It was like a potato shape. But you could change all the different senses of his body. And that was part of the game. So you could give him different eyes, different eyebrows, different ears, different lips, different arms, different legs, a little bit of hair, sometimes a hat. So you know, basically it was the same as the potato head, but he got a different set of, and it was a lot of fun. So, and each time you change, you know, those different set of senses, you know, he looked like a different sort of a character that did different things in this world. So we're all like Mr. and Mrs. Potato Head. You know, we come into this world and we just, you know, attach a whole bunch of different senses. So it's quite mechanical when you think. It's like, you know, we say that Mr. Ford, who he was considered the person we give credit to for the automating, you know, the, what do they call that, mass producing cars and that, instead of building one car at a time, you know, there's basically, they go along the roller belt, you know, and the doors are already there, you know, the everything, you just attach them and it just sort of rolls off as a car at the end. So creating the body, actually Krishna is the originator of that idea, right? So, you know, you just take from that body of senses, etc., and elements, and the living entity comes in, and this subtle body, and they just get that different group according to, you know, whether you want a four-wheel drive or a sports car type body or, you know, a little mini miner or a, you know, a big Hummer. So it's exactly the same. So now, this here it goes on to say that verse 10, the foolish cannot understand how a living entity can quit his body, nor can they understand what sort of body he enjoys under the spell of the modes of nature. But those whose eyes are trained in knowledge can see all this. The endeavouring transcendentalist who is situated in self-realisation can see all this clearly. So one who understands the nature of the spirit soul, they can see all this. And they understand the nature of the supreme soul, they can see all this clearly. But those whose minds are not developed and who are not situated in self-realisation cannot see what is taking place, though they may try to. So, now this, as that verse 7 describes it, in this process, when we get this material body, and whether we get a body of a demigod, the body of a human, Indian, American, Australian, Chinese, the body of a dog, or the body of a cat, we struggle for existence in this material world because we have four major problems that every living entity from Brahma down to the little germ are facing. And that is, one is forced to repeatedly take birth, death, and in between there's old age and disease. So these problems are continuous for millions and millions and millions of lifetimes. So therefore, one who understands that if I'm eternal and changing bodies, why do I need to go through this process of death when it's something that's foreign to me? So I have to be permanent in order to change bodies. If I'm permanent, then why change a body? Why not just get a permanent situation? So of course, that permanent situation cannot be had with the material body because it is destructible. And so what happens, of course, is that instead of solving that problem, because we have a we actually take a particular set of senses, because in our subtle body, our mind, we want to actually enjoy a particular set of sense objects. So every species of life, you see that certain senses, generally in most species of life, one is very prominent. In human beings, all their senses are prominent. And so humans tend to want to enjoy a great variety of all the different sense objects fully, whereas in many species of life, they're generally particularly interested in, you know, a much more limited enjoyment of sense objects. And that becomes the problem, as described in that Bhagavad Gita, we're struggling with the six senses in the mind, that we're always facing happiness and distress in relationship to the how our senses are experiencing this world. Now, Krishna says, so our whole civilization is based upon not solving the actual problems, birth, death, old age, and disease. We solve all the problems of life wholesale, everything. If we don't take another material body, all the problems we face having a material body are solved. But in our civilization, instead of trying to solve birth, death, old age, and disease by coming to a permanent position on the spiritual platform, we spend our time trying to solve this problem of enjoying the senses in the material world, where there's always happiness and distress. Now, Krishna, he gives, in the Bhagavad Gita, he says, you can solve all of those problems related to happiness and distress very easily. And he says, you just tolerate it. That's it. That's it. Problem solved. It's a pretty idiot. In the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada was saying that. You speak on these verses. And that's how you solve all the problems of life. You tolerate. So, of course, in our modern scientific world, you know, if there's some difficulty to raise the toothbrush from the, you know, about the waist level all the way up to the mouth, which could be, you know, quite difficult for a lot of people. So we invent the electric toothbrush. And, you know, well, what we also need is a little elbow push up. So much trouble, so much difficulty. And, the whole civilization, that if there's a little problem, you know, for instance, I quite often see people, you know, because now we're in winter, and they're freezing, and they're thinking, let me get inside, oh, the heat is not working, there's no electricity, and I think to myself, why don't you just put a jumper on, because they don't have a jumper on, right? They don't think like that anymore. You know, all problems are solved by electricity, heaters, something, you know, technologically. And you think, you know, why not put a jumper on? It's really easy. Actually, the previous generation, you know, we sometimes think, how did the previous generation, how did they even manage, you know, without all the technological advancement that we had? They must have been so cold and so hot and so, but they didn't, because actually they just tolerated. You know, we wonder, how did they get on? They actually tolerated so much. And my mother's 80 years old, over 80. Every day, without fail, even if she's sick, throughout winter, throughout summer, she'll go and sit out on the porch and sit there for hours. Throughout the day, she spent several hours just sitting out on the porch. People walk, looking at the garden, looking at the flowers growing. People have walked past. They all know, everyone, you know. It's very strange, because no one knows any old people these days. But they all know my mum. Because she's always sitting on the porch. But I got her a heater, like a you know, you can turn it on, heat comes out, pulls in some, and then we'd be able to use it. And she just doesn't need it because over the course of a lifetime, she just, you know, she just used to it. She just accommodates to a certain degree. So that generation would do that. I remember a teenager, I was a bit of a hippie. Prabhupada noticed within the hippies, especially in America, that, you know, they had that ability, that they were like that as well, that they would just sleep on the street, outdoors, you know, at the end of the day, wherever they happened to be, just lay down somewhere, in the park, on the streets, you know, because Prabhupada used to say that, he said, you see them, the hippies, they're sleeping on the streets, you know, and, but they didn't seem to mind because they just tolerated. They didn't want, they actually wanted to turn their back on, you know, this constant, scientific advancement, you know, for the sake of making things so complicated. They wanted things to be a little bit more natural and they just had that sense. But, of course, you know, there were many things that they didn't understand. Prabhupada, you know, he saw that within them, but he said that they had no direction. You know, so there was detachment there, but, you know, they're up and down into all sorts of things. They had no real guidance and direction. So a little guidance, and, you know, they could properly utilize that. So as a young teenager, I was quite interested in that concept where just by the control of the mind, you could actually rise above, you know, the happiness and distress of the world. And probably one of the biggest breakthroughs I had when I was a teenager, I used to get this, I don't know what it was called, but my glands in my throat, glandular fever or something, but it was almost like, you know, it had knives sticking in your throat. It was so painful. It was like you had glass, you know, if you moved your mouth, it was like broken glass in your throat, and it was just so painful, yeah, so very painful. Eyes running, splitting headache, you know, body aching, sometimes fever, you know, blocked nose, everything like that. Could barely breathe, could barely talk. I used to get that a lot for some reason. well, I know the reason. I was a hippie doing all sorts of nonsense. My immune system was sort of, you know, ruined, and so I was getting ill. But anyway, one day I was so ill that this friend of mine, they took me to a meditation place where it was natural healing. And what they got me to do was to lay down on a table, some cushions in, and they said that just close your eyes and meditate, because I was so locked up I could barely breathe and there was a lot of pain, and they said just meditate that you're in a rose garden, and they would say, can you say, get your eyes shut, they'd say, can you see the roses? Yes. Okay. Take one of those roses. Smell the rose. So I'm smelling the rose. Can you smell the rose? Yes. So just breathe in your own of that rose. And so I did that. So at one stage, I kept doing that and breathing. Pretty deep like that. And they tapped me after some time. Now, I thought I'd only been there for a couple of minutes. But they said I'd been there for about 20, 25 minutes or something. It's almost like I disappeared. And when I sat up off that table, I had no symptoms of the illness that I walked into that room with. So not only had I mentally overridden, but literally physically, because of such a change in the subtle body, I literally walked, I could breathe, I had no headache, I had, you know, everything gone. Literally walked out, I thought, gee, that was really good. And since then, I actually started to do more meditation and just trying to develop that ability. And Prabhupada explains it because you just take your consciousness. It's that principle of tolerating. When you tolerate, it means okay, there's so much cold, so much heat. Let me just not think about it too much. Just take my mind away from it to something else, something better. Because for us, that's Krishna. That works really well. Should try. But for others, it may be roses. But so you imagine with the potency of Krishna compared to just even just thinking of something that isn't there. Prabhupada explains that one time he was watching this friend of his family doctor who was going to operate on a child. They had, I think they had a boil or something on their leg, and they had to lance it, a lot of pain. And Prabhupada said to the doctor, "Oh, you're going to give some anesthetic or something?" He said, no need. It's a child. They won't feel it because their consciousness is not there. And Prabhupada watched. And the doctor, cut and what have you. And the child made no indication that there was any pain or anything because the consciousness was somewhere else. And so now, as a devotee, I had a similar experience, but on a more transcendental level. I remember in 1980, I was in Tasmania. I was a brahmachari. I was with Nirudha Prabhu and Pushpanjali, I think it was. So there were about three or four of us. And we were staying in Cape, we were doing Sankirtan over there. And Tasmania, of course, gets very, very cold. And I actually got this similar illness, exactly the same. With the throat and everything like that. And I was so ill. Of course, in those days, as a brahmachari, we never went to the doctor. It just wasn't in the program. It wasn't within the jurisdiction of management. I remember one time, I was on Sankirtan, and I got attacked. Someone smashed me over the head with might have been an iron bar from behind. Not this tooth, still right out of my head, that's why I don't have that tooth. And spit my nose, black eye like that, knocked me out, and stole all my Sankirtan money. Anyway, I went back to the temple. I got one day off Sankirtan. And that was, they were being kind to me. So, but anyway, so we didn't go to the doctors. I was really suffering. I had this. So when I went to sleep, I dreamt that my spiritual master appeared to me in my dream. And I said, "Oh, it's a good day. You've flown in." And he sort of looked at me and smiled. And I said, "Oh, good day. I'm so sick. I don't know if I can do my service." He said, "No." So he had this jar, and like a clear jar, and then he lifted off the lid, and there was Maha sweets in there. And he said, "Oh, have one of these." So I dipped my hand in, and I had one Maha sweet. And I ate that Maha sweet, and I thought, "Oh, they're really nice." And I went to dip in and get the other one. He said, "No, that's all you need." And he put the lid on, and then he disappeared. And I woke up, and when I woke up, I was in so much bliss that I had no sense. I could, I could actually feel, like with the headache, sometimes your head is throbbing with the pain and everything like that. I could feel all the symptoms of the illness, and I had no sensation of any pain at all. It was like I was just floating in bliss, like a little soul separated from the body, from that. As a moment. So you can imagine that at the time of death, by the grace of Krishna. That, you know, the experience of death for a devotee is different. That Krishna can just detach you from that situation. So, you know, therefore, when I became a devotee, I really enjoyed the concept of the austerities that devotees performed, because, you know, the devotees were just tolerating everything. They weren't doing it, you know, to fix their illness or, you know, to be a hippie or, you know, the devotees were tolerating happiness and distress, the senses, because they wanted to help people in this world, you know, detach themselves from the material body and go back home, back to Godhead. So then there was a whole dimension of purpose. So you're not just doing, you're not practicing that just for your own pleasure, but you're practicing the same thing. You're getting all the benefits of just tolerating, and at the same time, you're doing it because you're particularly wanting to help people. Because you can see, as mentioned in that verse, Prabhupada mentions, that even if others who are not trained in self-realization, even if they try to understand how we get these material bodies, how we get rid of these material bodies, how the universe is created, how it's, you know, the universe is dissolved, they can't understand. So, you know, therefore, as we said, Prabhupada saw that there was detachment, but they used to speak in terms of, you know, sometimes, like in 1966, they were asking Srila Prabhupada, you know, what do you think about cosmic consciousness? You know, because cosmic consciousness, Prabhupada would, you know, quite often say, what do you mean? And then they would give some answer, and he'd go, what do you mean? And then they would give some answer, what do you mean? And then they would be, and then Prabhupada would say, so you really don't know, you know, because literally they had no real concept. It was sort of, it was hip, you know. It was hip to be squick, to be like that. So anyway, but they really had no idea. It was fashionable, army cosmic consciousness. But, you know, their idea was that if you transcended the body, then your consciousness somehow merged with the consciousness of the, you know, the universe, the cosmos. That they felt that they had some sense that there was an intelligence within the universe, and that by rising above, the way to solve the problems of happiness and distress in this world was not necessarily by tolerating it, but by rising up to cosmic consciousness, where you are as great as the whole universe, like that. So that was their solution. So now, and that is because, and this is where Srila Prabhupada came in and taught them the principles of the Bhagavad Gita, that. And he explained this to, you know, people who had asked those questions, that actually you are an individual, you know, and they would say, yes, but don't you merge? You know, when you see here in this verse, it says, you know, Prithi Maharaj, he merged the whole of his senses with the sky. So, you know, these terms are there. He's merging this and merging that, and gradually, you know, they feel that, oh, Prithi Maharaj will merge and become in cosmic consciousness, become one. But actually, what we see here is that this individual, this one individual is doing that. Not everyone, all at once, but just one person and other individuals and all. So while he's, and Prabhupada said, he said, actually, you're an individual, but you're merged in the material energy already. Because, you know, basically, it's like this, that, you know, if an aeroplane flies in the sky and you're watching it, and you're watching it, and then it just little point and it just disappears and so it's merged into the sky. See? So that's our position. The material energy is so vast, and we're such a tiny little. Prabhupada said in those days, he said, spiritual atom. He said, this material energy, if you look at it, it all comes down to all these individual atoms, and we're a little spiritual atom, eternally individual, and we've merged into the material energy. But that, just like an aeroplane flying into the sky and just merges. But we know that although we can't see that aeroplane, still that aeroplane is there, there's so many passengers, there's so many passengers like that. Or, as Ramanujacharya mentions, that you know, sometimes a green bird flies into a green tree, and we think, oh, it's merged. But actually, you know, the bird is different. There's so many other birds, and it's probably got a little family there. As we know from Bhagavatam, in every species of life, the same thing is going on. So, Prabhupada said, therefore, he said, when you merge into the, become one with the spiritual energy, you still also keep your individuality. In other words, if we're merged into the spiritual material energy and we still have our individuality, then certainly when we merge into the spiritual energy, we also keep our spiritual individuality. So, now, and that is because, Prabhupada said, here, as we learn from this verse, because we're a spiritual atom, an eternal spiritual atom, when the spiritual atom enters into the body, into the womb of the mother, the body develops. If there's no life there, the body will not develop. No body will develop until the spiritual atom, which is symptomized by pure consciousness, the spiritual atom is literally an atomic particle of pure consciousness. This is what a spiritual atom is. When that enters within the womb, then the body will develop, otherwise the body will not develop. And similarly, Srila Prabhupada says, when you go to Krishna in the spiritual world, the spiritual atom, it develops the spiritual body, and you go to Krishna in your spiritual form. So, again, in those same verses that we read, I'll just read a little bit of what Prabhupada says about that in the purport. So, in this verse, Bhagavad Gita 15.7, Srila Prabhupada says this, that it is stated that when a living entity gives up this material embodiment and enters into the spiritual world, he revives his spiritual body, and in his spiritual body, he can see the Supreme Personality face to face. He can hear and speak to him face to face, and he can understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead as he is. In the spiritual planet, everyone lives in bodies featured like the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As far as as body construction is concerned, there is no difference between the part and parcel living entities and the expansions of Vishnumurti. In other words, at liberation, the living entity gets a spiritual body by the grace of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The way the Prabhupada words that the atomic, we know that the atomic, the spirit soul, its dimension is, if you take the tip of the hair, the very tip of it, the smallest part of it at the end, and divide that into 1/10,000th apart, something which cannot be seen by any material scientific apparatus, that is the dimension of the soul. And that atomic spiritual particle of pure consciousness leaving this body, Srila Prabhupada says, as that spirit soul can develop this material body around it, that spirit soul can develop the spiritual body, which when goes to Krishna, one sees Krishna face to face. So, and one gets a body exactly like the Lord. If one meditates upon that, Krishna says, "Yita mam, was that yita mam prajante tamstate vijamyam." Yeah, that's right. And as one surrenders unto me, I reward them accordingly. So, in that verse there, again, Srila Prabhupada says the same things. Now that verse is a couple of verses after the verse where Krishna says, if you can understand my birth and activities in this world, that they're all spiritual, you understand my spiritual form, personality, upon leaving this body, you will not take birth again. And in the 15th chapter it says, where do you go? You go to the spiritual world and you get a form like Krishna's. So in that verse, text number 11, Srila Prabhupada again describes this process of getting a spiritual body. There's in the transcendental world also, Krishna reciprocates with his pure devotees in the transcendental attitude, just as the devotee wants him. One devotee may want Krishna as the supreme master, another as his personal friend, another as his son, and still another as his lover. Krishna rewards all the devotees equally according to the different intensities of love for him. And so if we develop that love for Krishna, determines the particular spiritual features that develop around the tongue, the spirit soul, manifests as this beautiful spiritual form, which is exactly appropriate to reciprocate with Krishna in that particular mood of love. So the form is completely compatible with one's mood of love of God. So if we develop the love for God, then that's how the spiritual body manifests. And now there's a story. How potent. Now you can imagine the devotees. Now the devotees are actually trying to preach Krishna consciousness, which Krishna says, there is no one in this world more dear to me than that person who's trying to preach. And in preaching, the devotees are themselves always remembering Krishna because they're serving Krishna and they're helping others to remember Krishna. And that is developing their love for Krishna, which is developing their spiritual body, which they will receive. Now, there was one demon called Pundraka. Pundraka, he sent a message to Krishna in Dwarka that I am Vasudeva, who's descended out of my causeless mercy to deliver all the conditioned souls in this material world. So, Krishna, you rascal, you give up these symbols because otherwise there'll be a battle and I'll have to kill you. So this Pundraka, he was so absorbed in envy of Krishna, that I will be Krishna, that he took all the symbols of Krishna. So he had the conch, and the disc, and the club. He had the garland, the kasturba. I think he even had the Srivats. I'm not sure if there's a picture there. I'd like to see the picture. Did he have the four arms?
Yes.
He did. Yes. That's what I thought. He had, in the picture, he had it. So he'd actually... So it was all decoration. Huh? So even he had the four arms. So when Krishna received this letter with all the, his friends, they laughed for a long time to their full satisfaction. And then Krishna decided, enough's enough. We'll have to go and kill him. So he went there.
He sent him a letter first.
Thank you. And actually, I'm telling this story because as we're driving, Sriverdi always reads me these Krishna stories, and this one popped back in her head because it was so appropriate to this verse. Anyway, so if I miss any details, you can tell me. But so anyway, they got to Kasi, because Pundraka was staying with his friend, the king of Kasi, the king of the Kalingas. And Kasi, is that Varanasi?
Yes.
Yeah, where Lord Shiva, Lord Shiva resides at Vishwanath. There's a temple still there to this day, of Vishwanath, very famous. Lord Chaitanya went there, and sometimes they call him Vishveshwara. Anyway, so then, to cut a long story short anyway, basically, Krishna asked him, to give up. There were some fighting words, and Krishna told him, to give up, and there was a challenge there. So anyway, Krishna... he shot some arrows and his, the chariot just disintegrated into a million bits, and then he, with his Sudarshan Chakra, he cut off his head. Now, that Pundraka, because he was killed by Krishna, he was actually destroyed by all his offences were destroyed because Krishna killed him. Yeah, by the touch of Krishna. And therefore, because he was always meditating on the form of the Lord, he attained Sarupya Mukti. And he went to Vaikuntha and attained a form just like the Lord, like us. Because that was his constant 24-hour-a-day meditation. Now, don't imitate that. Don't think, oh, why am I chanting all these rounds? Preaching Krishna consciousness. Don't make Krishna come here and kill you. He probably won't. And then God only knows what happens at the time that Maya kills you for being offended. So don't imitate that. But take this, that if we can somehow or another always meditate upon the form of the Lord, we actually get a form exactly like the Lord's, Satchitananda. Not that we become God, but we remain individuals, but it's appropriate to reciprocate with the Supreme Lord in love. Now, if a demon can attain that, imagine the success. That is, these pastimes are there because Krishna is letting us know. You serve me. Prabhupada would say, one lifetime, you chant 16 rounds, follow four regular principles, Krishna preach Krishna consciousness. One lifetime, you go back to Godhead. You do it properly, one life, that's it. Isn't it supreme? So anyway, I'll just leave that there if anyone has any comments or questions on that. Yep. What's that?
Question. How to beat the mind with shoes?
What's that?
How do we beat the mind with shoes?
How do we beat the mind with shoes? Yeah. So basically, what is it? It's at the end of the day, you beat the mind 100 times with a broomstick, and in the morning you beat it 100 times with shoes. Is that it? That's Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakura would say
it's
that.
It's more intense in the night time.
That's right, yeah. That's the point. That, you know, see, there's also the broomstick. You can't leave out the broomstick. So there's 100 times with a broomstick. The broomstick is a real heavy beating. So, and if the mind's just playing up a little bit, okay, we can take it easy. It's just 100 times with the slippers. So the point is that 100 times beating means we really make sure that the mind doesn't think of anything else but Krishna. That's what it means. Beating the mind means that the mind is saying, I'm not going to chant my rounds today. Oh, is that right? It's a slipper. Or you might get a boon. So, you know, we beat it. You know, we just say to the mind, no, I'm not listening to you. That's another tolerance. I'm not listening. Not interested. I'm still here and I'm not chanting around. That's all right. You're a rascal. I've listened to you for hundreds and hundreds of lifetimes and you're nothing but a rascal. You always cause me trouble. All my troubles in the material world are because of you, you rascal. So you're beating the mind. You're really putting the mind in until it just whimpers away and just disappears. You defeat it. So, you know, we preach to people. In a sense, we're giving them, you know, a few taps with the slippers. But for our own mind, we preach stronger. So we preach very gently with people. To, you know, their mind is saying so many things. And we try and stop their mind so that they can finally listen to a devotee. But for our own mind, we're very strong. Our main preaching is to ourselves. That's the point. And that preaching is that we just treat the mind like a rascal. You know, when you're beating someone with a broomstick, means what a rascal that person is. They deserve the broomstick. Right? Even the slipper. 100 times with the slipper. He's a big rascal. So, you know, it means you treat the mind like the rascal it is. You know, Raghunath Das Goswami, he says, you know, why do I allow my mind to urinate on my consciousness every day like this? You know? Yeah. The mind is, you know, brings these foul, you know, thoughts into our head. And he prays like that, you know, in all humility. Why do I let it do that? You know, if a dog came up to you and urinated on you, what would you do? Beat it. But the mind does, oh, that's okay, that's my mind, you can do it anytime it wants. You think your mind is supposed to be my friend, the last person I think would be urinating all over you. It makes it even worse. So, you know, we treat the mind like that. If it causes this trouble, that saying you know, you're not getting out of bed today to do your service, you're not going to chant your rounds, you're not going to read your sloka, you know, whatever like that, and then, you know, we treat the mind like a rascal until it just runs away. Yeah. Yeah. And the second question, right? Yeah. I always thought that myself. How did he, you know, attach these other two hands? So, you know, it was all decoration, you know, it describes there that everything he had was like cosmetic decoration, you know, there's nothing was the real thing in one sense.
Like a performer on the stage.
Like a performer on the stage, it describes, like a, you know, that, and so, you know, they laughed in the palace, but then when Krishna and Balaram went there, they laughed again when they saw him. A long, long time. I laughed so much. And it was so funny. But I always thought that, you know, how foolish. But, as Prabhupada says, he had this conception that he was God, and then all his followers said, yes, we believe you're God, and that was the end of it. And that's what happens. Sometimes you get these gurus, they have some concept, I think I've got cosmic consciousness, or I'm God, or I'm Narayan. And then they get millions of people follow them, and that's the end of them. Then they think, oh yes, yeah, all this, I'm definitely God, like that. Okay. So, and even though They're a laughable joke, you know. So when devotees see these imposter gods, we laugh, like Krishna did. You know. And we laugh at them and we laugh at the followers. It's a tragic comedy. A tragic comedy means it is so sad that they are so foolish that it is so funny you can't stop laughing. It's a tragic comedy. But if you ever hear where he got those other two hands, let me know. But I've always thought that myself, how did he attach them and why people were so foolish. You know, they see him get dressed in the morning, oh, you know, the Sri Vats this, that, and the other two hands, oh God.
Was he a king?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. He was a king and everything.
Hare Krishna,
Guruji.
You mentioned that in the spiritual world, the problems like birth, old age, disease and death, they are not in the spiritual world.
Mm.
So then how does Krishna kill the demons every day?
Yeah, because when Krishna kills the demons, just like Krishna, he utilizes his different energies. Right? So, because God is all spiritual, his energy is just spiritual. There is no material for God. But he can make his spiritual energy, Brahman, as we read, act materially. So, the same energy for Krishna, he's acting spiritually, but the demons are acting materially. So, for instance, when you get to a set of traffic lights, there's one energy which is controlling everyone. And yet that same energy makes some people stop and makes some people go. But it's only one energy. So when Krishna's energy makes one serve Krishna, that's like go forward, you get the green light to spiritually to serve Krishna, that is yoga maya. And when the same energy acts to make you oppose the service of Krishna, that is the Mahamaya, that is the same energy. Therefore, Prabhupada said, one of his disciples asked him about, you know, who is Subhadra? And Prabhupada said, Subhadra is Durga Devi. And then, because, you know, the person who asked the question was a little bit more confused. You know, Durga Devi, she's the goddess of the material energy. And Prabhupada said, yes. And he said, have you read Brahma Samhita? There it says that Radharani is also known as Durga. So, ultimately, God's one energy, Srimati Radharani, the full potency of the Lord, her expansion manifests as Durga Devi or the different expansion of Durga. So then those sages who are Prabhupada, so does Durga Devi exist in the spiritual world? Is it not? But he says, but she exists in the spiritual world not as Durga but as Yoga Maya. So in Vrindavan, Yogamaya, the spiritual energy which allows all the devotees to serve Krishna and love Krishna, she is personified as Purnamasi. And they all serve in Vrindavan under Purnamasi's arrangements, Yogamaya. They've got the green light. In Dwarka, that expansion of yoga maya is Subhadra. And she's giving the green light. Everyone is serving there. Slightly differently, but like that. And either in Dwarka, Vrindavan, or Mathura, for the demons, they're under Mahamaya. Now, one time someone asked Prabhupada, what was Arjuna's position when he refused to serve Krishna? And Prabhupada said he was under Mahamaya. So there's Arjuna right next to Krishna. And he's in. So Krishna's performing his spiritual pastimes, that's his leela, in the Vasudeva feature. Arjuna's right next to him, and yet Prabhupada's saying that was a Mahamaya. Now we have to understand that, of course, for someone like Arjuna is placed under Mahamaya differently from us. When we're under Mahamaya, we've really forgotten our eternal relationship with Krishna. But Arjuna, even under Mahamaya, where he's refusing to serve Krishna, he still knows Krishna's God. And therefore he's asking questions to clear the path of understanding for us in the Bhagavad Gita, because he knows his God and he's clearing that understanding for us in his questions. But also, Arjuna being under Mahamaya is different from us, because who did Arjuna marry?
Subhadra.
So, you know, we can't compare us being under Mahamaya with Arjuna being under Mahamaya, but he was under Mahamaya. But he has a very close relationship with Subhadra. So it's a little different. It's not the same level. There are different levels of where the conjunction of the spiritual energy and the material energy are there within the spiritual pastimes of Krishna. Okay. So Krishna can do anything, one energy, and he can do anything he likes, make it act in different ways, so the demons can come, and yet it doesn't touch the spiritual nature of Krishna. Yeah?
Do you mind if I add?
I can't believe you understand that. That's how we're trying to get someone to understand. There is spirit soul. I'm just speaking that. She said, that's good. I'm good. Thank you. But she does. I can see it. Yeah.
There are a couple of traditional answers to that question.
Yeah.
One is that in the spiritual world, there's the appearance of demons. The Krishna has to come to the material world in order to embellish that pastime.
Yeah, so that's right. Those killing of the demons doesn't happen in the Goloka, in the spiritual sky. They happen when Krishna comes here to this. So when Krishna comes with the spiritual world in the conjunction of material and spiritual energy, they happen, but not in the spiritual sky. Yeah? Yeah, did you have there was another one?
I think I already used up my two.
That's in that one. That's good.
Very but indeed. I have a question.
Yes. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you nice for one. Such a wide-ranging class. Mm. These verses about Maharaj Prithu returning all his material facility to Krishna. Can us humble atomic souls understand that through Yukta Vairagya? There's actually a very pertinent. I looked in Veda base in Vanipurts for Yukta Vairagya and came up with 827 purport, which describes how the wording doesn't, as you were describing, Srila Prabhupada says that we don't so much worry about the different yogic processes, but we engage what we have.
Yes, so when we're the wonderful thing about, as it's mentioned in the end of Bhakti Yoga, the end of the 8th chapter, I'll read this one verse to you, that It says, text 28, it's the last verse of chapter 8, it says, Vedashu Jyotishu Tapashu Cheva Danishu Yat Pumya Palam Parishtam Ajeti Tat Saravam Itam Vedashva Yogi Param Saram Upaiti Chajam. A person who accepts the path of devotional service is not bereft of the results derived from studying the Vedas, performing sacrifices, undergoing austerities, giving charity, or pursuing philosophical and fruitive activities. Simply by performing devotional service, he attains all these, and at the end, he reaches the supreme eternal abode. So many of those things are automatic, but that means that the devotee perceives that they're getting the results of these very easily. So some of the things that may be done quite mechanically and with a little difficulty, the devotee automatically experiences. You know, I told the story about getting the Maha Prasad in a dream. You know, there's such an easy way by Krishna's grace somehow, because I was undergoing a little difficulty to preach, that Krishna made some arrangement, so I get a little taste of what yogis, you know, spend lifetimes trying to do, a little Maha Prasad in my dream, and then I get the same experience. So, you know, for a devotee, they experience these things, but it's much more automatic. And, yes, there's no loss. Yeah. One last question.
When Krita Maharaj is exhibiting exemplary behavior, like that the citizens and other people would follow, going to one person, he doesn't need to, but he did everything so that he can show everyone what to do.
Yes.
So why does in the final moment, that is his death, he is separating like that instead of the traditional one which other people should follow?
No, actually in his age, because of many yogis performing meditation, and they may not know that meditation means to meditate in such a way that you will attain a spiritual form in the spiritual world. So he's performing, just like one performs the activity of a king or a grihastha to show others how to do that, he's performing the activities of a yogi to show the yogis how to do it properly. Therefore, as we see, in this purport to the verse I read in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 15, text number 10, says the purport explains that. So it describes that it was verse number 11, described how the endeavouring transcendentalists, they can see everything clearly, changing bodies, but those whose minds are not developed cannot do so, though they may try to. And in the purport, there are many transcendentalists on the path of spiritual self-realisation. So especially in the time of Prithvi Maharaj, we can imagine how many are trying to. But one who is not situated in self-realisation, which means that I am the eternal part of the Lord, the fragmental part of the Lord, tiny little part of the Supreme, that self-realisation must be in connection with the Supreme. They cannot see how things are changing the body of the living entity. The word yogina is significant in this connection. In the present day, there are many so-called yogis and there are many so-called associations of yogis, but they're actually blind in the matter of self-realization. They're simply addicted to some sort of gymnastic exercise and are satisfied if the body is well-built and healthy. They have no other information. They are called yatanto vyagrita manaha. Even though they are endeavouring in a so-called yoga system, they are not self-realized. Such people cannot understand the process of transmigration of the soul. Only those who are actually in the yoga system and have realized the self, the world, and the Supreme Lord, in other words, the bhakti yogis, those engaged in pure devotional service in Krishna consciousness, can understand how things are taking place. Because Prithvi Maharaj is a bhakti yogi, in his age, where there are people sincerely, properly trying to, you know, follow the path of self-realization, he's showing them that you must actually do it as a bhakta to do it properly. Yeah. All right. Good. Jai. How are you?